And sometimes it's useful to look for things that are common to small groups of people. This morning we will be talking about something that in a way is both, and it is menstruation. As a biological phenomenon, it is universal. Women all over the world have periods, but that's probably where the universality ends. Menstruation is also a cultural phenomenon, and there is a great variety in the way that it is viewed from one society to the next. This morning we will look at how it is viewed in our society and also in other places, and we'll be talking with Alma Gottlieb, who is an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois, who has done some research in this area. She is the co-editor, along with Thomas Buckley, of a book that's come out recently entitled Blood Magic, The Anthropology of Menstruation. It's published by University of California Press. And as we talk, of course, you're welcome to call in with some questions or comments of your own. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you hear the radio station, and that's 800-222-9455. And one of the things that we will begin talking about here is premenstrual syndrome and the idea that it is not something that's found everywhere, but we'll get into that in a moment. Professor Gottlieb is joining us this morning by telephone, and good morning.
Good morning, David.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
One of the things that I want to do as we try and take this cross-cultural look at menstruation is to also talk about the attitudes that we have it here in have about it here in the United States and some of our own taboos about it, although people probably don't think about it that way. I have this feeling that we may already have broken one, and that is we're talking about it and on the radio of all places.
That's right.
And I imagine some people would be curious about why you would want to study this. You know, of all of the things that as an anthropologist one might study, why this?
Well, I started out studying menstruation in Africa, actually, not in America. And I studied it because the people whom I were working with in Ivory Coast, an ethnic group called the Beng, were very interested in it themselves. And there's a venerable tradition of research in anthropology on menstruation. And the single theme that emerges in a huge amount of literature in anthropology is that menstruation is universally seen as a curse. Mm-hmm. That it is seen as degrading, polluting, defiling, makes women dirty, serves as a source of lower status for women, and so forth. And so I went to Africa not necessarily particularly interested in menstruation, but if I had any notions of menstruation at all, as an anthropological phenomenon, it was that as a background. And I was very struck in the Beng village that I worked in Ivory Coast with how different attitudes to menstruation were. I was talking one day with a traditional priest about why women were prohibited to do certain activities when they were menstruating, and I expected him to say the usual line that I'd been led to believe in anthropology, that women are polluting and dirty. And instead he said, menstruation is like a flower. He said, on a tree you need a flower first before the tree can fruit. And menstruation is like the flower that you need before the fruit can be born, that is, the child. And I was very struck by that extraordinarily poetic statement, and it was poetic in a very positive way that I just had really been unprepared for with my anthropological training. Mm. So I started pursuing the matter further and found that attitudes toward the menstruation in general were, shall we say, far more positive among the Beng than I'd been led to expect. And so when I got back, I started looking at attitudes toward menstruation in other cultures and found that there was a tremendous variety, not necessarily that it was positive all over the place, that's certainly not the case, but that the attitudes really varied extraordinarily in a way that had really been ignored by anthropology. So although there was a lot of work in anthropology on menstruation, it all tended to emphasize a single theme, and the more I looked at the literature, the more I thought that was quite inaccurate. And so after having completed a lot of research cross-culturally on menstruation elsewhere, which is the focus of my collection of articles, I then went back to the U.S. and started looking at menstruation customs in the U.S. with my knowledge of menstruation customs elsewhere as a background and was really struck at how culturally peculiar our own attitudes are, although we like to think that they're very scientifically based and somehow universal.
Well, I'd like to talk about some of those things. Let's talk a bit about premenstrual syndrome.
Okay.
Now, here, this is something that we're used to hearing about. There's been a lot of discussion of it in the media, and it is this set of symptoms. Some of them are psychological, some of them are physiological, that some women report before they have their periods. And then there can be a great deal of variability. It seems to be rather different from one woman to the next.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that that we have been talking about more and more, and seems to become a fairly accepted idea that it does really exist, that it's not something that women are imagining, but that there's something physiological going on that's related to these symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So you would expect that since menstruation is a worldwide phenomenon, that one, you would also expect that as you went around the world, you would find premenstrual syndrome too in other places. But it seems to be the case that you don't, that it's something that you find in the industrialized world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to say that women in other places don't report some discomfort when they have their periods.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also not to say that women here in the United States that talk about having premenstrual syndrome are somehow making it up,
mm-hmm.
but that you don't find it in a lot of other places in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, why?
Yeah, well, you've summarized my whole argument very well. I couldn't have done it better. Thank you. It is very striking to me that we in the West believe so firmly in premenstrual syndrome as a biological phenomenon, and yet it is simply absent in at least six societies in the world that I know of where it's been documented as being absent, and probably many, many others where anthropologists just haven't talked about it or asked about it. As early as the 1920s, Margaret Mead actually made her reputation early on with fieldwork that she did in Samoa on young girls and women, and a book called Coming of Age in Samoa that made her famous. And one of the striking conclusions that she reached in that book was that around the time of menstruation, and in the 20s nobody really talked about PMS, people just talked about discomfort around the time of menstruation rather than so much before. And around menstruation, she said she was very struck by the fact that young girls and women just didn't seem to go through the kinds of psychological trauma that American women go through. And she reports that she asked young girls and women, well, what about irritability and crabbiness? Don't you get crabby? And they just sort of stared at her, and they said, well, no, why should we? We get cramps. It hurts. Sometimes we have to sit down, and we don't do all the work we otherwise do, but why should we get crabby? So already 60 years ago, there was the possibility of an absence of PMS elsewhere that just got ignored, really. And in the past few years, several other people, myself included, have documented a total absence of the kinds of psychological or mood changes that we associate with the menstrual cycle in other cultures. Marjorie Shostak, an anthropologist who worked with the Kung women, so-called bush women of southern Africa, essentially got the exact response with them as Margaret Mead did. She asked them, what happens at menstruation? And they say, well, sometimes we get cramps. And she said, well, what about, don't you get mad at your husbands? Don't you get irritable? Don't you get moody? And they just sort of stared incomprehensibly and said, no, why would we? So it now seems clear to me, at least, that the kinds of psychological changes that we have identified with a menstrual cycle are peculiarly Western. And I do want to emphasize, as you brought up, that the sorts of biological changes that happened that happen in the West are probably universal, although, again, they're I'm not 100% confident making that claim because we just don't know. But there's probably a good chance that women everywhere suffer at least cramps and possibly bloating. But even the biological contours of menstruation tend to vary far more than we would assume. For instance, in the West, women menstruate regularly over a course of anywhere from 20 to 30 years, generally once a month for that entire time, perhaps with a punctuation of 2 years without menstruating while they're pregnant for maybe an average of two pregnancies, and maybe a couple months if they're breastfeeding. So they're menstruating hundreds and hundreds of times in their lives. And in the rest of the world, where there's very little access to birth control and women spend a lot of their time being pregnant, and then once they have those babies, they spend a lot of time nursing. And the ways that women breastfeed in the non-Western world tends to delay the recurrence of the menstrual cycle for a much longer time than in the West. So in the non-Western world, women actually don't menstruate all that much. In fact, one anthropologist named Diane Bell has written to me in a letter that Australian Aboriginal women whom she's worked with have told her, one woman in particular told her, that she could count on the fingers of both hands how many times she'd menstruated in her entire life. This is an older woman. So the actual physical experience that women go through menstruating itself may be very different from society to society. So it's certainly not surprising that the psychological experience that women undergo would also be different. So then the question becomes, well, in the West, why do women experience the kinds of psychological and mood changes that we undeniably do? And my answer has to do with the ways that the feminine personality gets constructed in the West. What I suggest is that in the West, we have a very strict notion of how women should act in the world, and adjectives such as nice and gentle and sensitive to others and altruistic and generous come up all the time when you ask people what should women be like. You know, the little jingles of what little girls are made of and so forth readily come to mind. And it's a very strict set of expectations that we have for women. And on the other hand, there are certain kinds of behavior that we tell women they really are not allowed to engage in. They're not allowed to be hostile. They're not allowed to be aggressive. They're not allowed to be even assertive. In fact, when women are assertive, say, in the business world, they often get denounced as being aggressive for the same sorts of behavior that men are praised for being assertive. So there are all sorts of behaviors that women are really restricted from engaging in. And my argument is that it's precisely those behaviors which get negatively criticized as being aggressive and hostile that show up during so-called PMS. And what I'd say is that it's not a surprise. And essentially what I suggest is that PMS acts almost as a ritual sort of reversal of the normal sort of behavior that women are normally expected to engage in. And you don't find it in other parts of the world, because in other parts of the world you have very different expectations for female behavior.
So does that mean, if I'm understanding that correctly, does it mean that it's a kind of a rebellion against the roles that are imposed on women?
Partially, I would say that it can be a rebellion, but it's a very ironic sort of rebellion, because ultimately it doesn't get you anywhere. That is, if you rebel by acting irritable, hostile, and so forth during the premenstrual time, the ironic thing about it is that the way especially most husbands understand PMS, PMS has now been taken by most husbands to mean a time when women shouldn't be listened to because it's just PMS. And I have heard dozens and dozens of women tell me that whenever they voice any complaint during the few days before their menstrual period or right at the beginning of their menstrual period, their husbands just dismiss whatever they have to say by saying, oh, it's just your period coming on. In fact, one woman whom I was listening to said that the night before she expects her period, her husband just essentially turns her off and says, you know, we know your period is coming tomorrow, so why bother, right? It's not worth arguing about. And so although women, in a sense, are given license to complain during that period, it's a very temporary license that ultimately doesn't get them anywhere because it's not seen as being legitimate. So ultimately, it's a rebellion that I might say is doomed to failure.
This is very interesting. Is it your thinking that if we had a society that was truly where there was true equality, PMS would sort of disappear?
Yeah, I'm quite sure that would happen, although I wouldn't predict it for the U.S. because cultures change very slowly, and I'm not about to say that, you know, in 10 years all this will change because we'll be an egalitarian society. But essentially, I would say that PMS is the result of a system of values that we have concerning gender, and the values that we have concerning gender are very deep, as they are in any society, and they're not going to change quickly. Although women enter the workplace And look like they're doing more of what men are doing. Deep down inside, we still think that men and women have very different sort of mental makeups, mental constitutions, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. But just to give you a comparative perspective, in my book there is one article by Laura Appel, who worked with an ethnic group who lives in Borneo. The group is called the Rungis. And very strikingly, among the Rungis, there are absolutely no taboos concerning menstruation. There are no myths about the origins of menstruation. Menstruation there is essentially considered a non-topic. It's just not an issue. People aren't tremendously interested in it. She really had a tough time getting anybody to talk about it because they just don't think about it very much. And her analysis is that that's an outgrowth of the way men and women are constructed by the society at large. And in general, men and women are conceived of as being complementary, as being symmetrical. Some of her evidence is linguistic. For instance, there is only a single word for spouse. There is no specific term that defines husband and wife. If a person wants to refer to their spouse, they would have to use a word that translates as spouse. They couldn't say husband and wife. So the very terms for spouses aren't even differentiated by gender. And in general, she says that relations between men and women are very egalitarian. And as a result, it would be peculiar to really highlight menstruation because that would really make a lot out of the fact that women are different from men. And they just don't do that. They just don't see men and women as all that different.
Hmm.
Whereas certainly in the West, we do.
It seems that you know, before we had the name PMS,
mm-hmm.
before we had a label for
mm-hmm.
it, we, you know, when women would report these kinds of feelings, we treated them like it was a psychiatric illness.
That's right.
You know, we were prepared to, you know, accept this idea that, well, you know, women now, they're very emotional and
right.
they're subject to be tossed about on these sorts of emotional storms, and that's sort of the way they are. But we sort of said, well, but that's in their heads
mm-hmm.
somehow. When PMS was identified, a lot of people said that was really a step forward because
mm-hmm.
we said, look, there's chemistry in the body. It affects our behavior. That's what's going on here. It became physiologically understandable.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder do you really think that that was a step forward when we started to approach it slightly more rationally?
Well, it's a very good question. And ultimately, I don't think that it was at all a rational step, although we like to think that it was. And no, I don't think it was a step forward, although at the time I can see why people would have hailed it as a step forward, because at least we didn't any longer blame it on women's individual neuroses. And I want to be very careful to emphasize that my argument does not blame individual women for making up this disease.
Mm-hmm.
My argument is that it's a cultural construction that's very powerful that women buy into because the culture has socialized them into it, essentially. But the hormonal argument that we now advance, the supposedly scientific argument, ultimately I don't see as really being any improvement on the psychological argument. And ironically, it really hails back to earlier 19th century thinking about women that, again, blamed everything that women complained about on hormones. In the 19th century, in America and in Europe, and my argument extends to Western Europe too, not only America, women's moods were said to be powerfully shaped by their bodies, in this case not by hormones, but by their organs, specifically by their ovaries. So that in the 19th century there was really a notion that whatever moods women were going through, up, down, middle, or so forth, was ultimately traceable to their bodies. And I see the hormonal argument as really no different from that, you know, clad in fancy jargon with long hormonal names that sound impressive to us.
Mm.
But ultimately, we're making the same argument that women are no more than their bodies. And it's a very peculiar argument because we don't say that about men. And so the very fact that we keep emphasizing women and bodies and not talking about men and bodies, to me, is a really powerful sign that cultural forces are at work.
We have a caller here I'd like to include, and also to reintroduce, you may have just tuned in, those of you who are listening. Our guest is Alma Gottlieb. She is an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois. We've been talking about premenstrual syndrome as a cultural phenomenon, and also talking a bit, taking a cross-cultural approach to looking at menstruation. And also, I'd like to mention again the book, because you may be interested in doing some reading on this. Professor Gottlieb is the co-editor of a book, Blood Magic, The Anthropology of Menstruation. It's published by the University of California Press. If you'd like to get in on our discussion, ask questions, make your comments, you can do that by calling 333-9455 if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free anywhere else, the number is 800-222-9455. We have a caller right here on line number one. We'll talk with them. Hello.
Yes, good morning. It's interesting that the conversation has turned in the direction it has, because I had wanted to ask the speaker this morning if she's aware of the possibility of PMS being included in the next edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. I think it's called Postluteal Phase Disorder. And I wonder what you think about that, and if that's perhaps the next step in kind of institutionalizing this disorder that's now been labeled, and now it's perhaps going to be labeled as a psychiatric disorder.
Yes, yes, I am aware of that. And when it first was proposed about, I believe, 2 years ago, there was actually a little bit of an uproar from some portions of the feminist community, precisely for the reasons that you mentioned, that it seemed, A, to be institutionalizing a disease which is perhaps not a disease, and B, seemed to once again be blaming individual women as neurotic for something which, you know, I believe is far greater than individual women's sensibilities. There was a bit of an uproar, and the American Psychiatric Association considered it. They had a committee and decided to go ahead with the diagnosis and including it in their next edition. I view it as unfortunate for all the reasons which you summarized very well for me.
Of course, I think probably an additional reason, and this is perhaps cynical, is that many insurance companies won't reimburse mental health professionals for treating a disorder that's not listed in the DSM. So once PMS is listed, then women will be able to receive third-party reimbursement if they seek mental health help with that.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to imply that PMS doesn't exist, that is, that women who complain of the symptoms they have are making it up. I mean, that would really be an unfortunate misinterpretation. So in a sense, it's good that women have been given a certain amount of legitimacy by being able to at least voice complaints about these symptoms that they feel. You know, and by my saying that it doesn't exist in other societies is not going to not make it exist in our society. So I guess in a way I feel a little ambivalent about the designation. But ultimately I don't think it's gonna help society, although it may help individual women because of the insurance reasons that you suggested.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let me ask you, Professor Gottlieb, as I have been thinking about this, I think we want to be certain that we don't demean or denigrate women who report, you know, having PMS.
Absolutely.
And we don't want to say that, you know, we want to say what they're feeling is real. I mean, they're really feeling something. But, you know, I start thinking that it must be, though, that there is some learned component to this, that it has to do with interpreting what one feels in certain ways. So that must mean that PMS is a learned, in a sense, it's a learned behavior. And if that is true, I wonder who the teachers are. Is it other women? Is it mothers? Is it older sisters?
Yeah, that's a good question. That, to me, would be a really good line of research to follow up. It's something that I've just started doing, and I don't feel really confident, making grand pronouncements. But I can just give you a couple of examples from my own experience, ways that I see the sort of cultural complex being transmitted. When you go to a new gynecologist as a woman for the first time, there's a good chance that you'll be given a questionnaire to fill out on your previous health state, and there will inevitably be questions about your menstrual cycle. And on one questionnaire that I was given out, There was a single question saying, during the time of your menstruation or before, do you have bloating, cramps, dizziness, nausea, irritability? And to me, questions like that are extraordinarily revealing because they are immediately and unconsciously positing psychological changes, such as irritability, with physiological changes, such as bloating and cramps. And so they are in a sense, teaching you as a woman, okay, the consumer of this questionnaire, that something like irritability is a medical phenomenon and that it has ultimately a biological and perhaps hormonal basis. So in very subtle ways like that, just by seeing words like cramping and irritability lumped together in the same sentence, at a very unconscious level, I think women are taught without necessarily being aware of it, that psychological changes are biologically based. And that happens, you know, later when you start going to gynecological clinics, but I suspect, and I haven't done a study on this, and I'd love somebody to do it, that if you, for instance, looked at junior high school textbooks, I suspect that there'd be a lot of that sort of thing in there early on. I remember myself when I was in junior high school and going through home economics classes before PMS was really talked about, and we just talked about mood changes during the menstrual period itself, that that in a sense we were told by our home economics teachers that mood changers are normal, that it's normal to be cranky, irritable, hostile, etc., and that you could get out of gym class for it. I think probably right around early adolescence, when women or young girls are really most open to being taught about what's happening to their bodies, I suspect then that there's a barrage of information coming at them from schools, from films that they see in schools, textbooks, and from other girls, and possibly from their mothers, that teaches them that mood changes are acceptable.
Mm-hmm. We're talking this morning with U of I anthropologist Alma Gottlieb, and we'll talk some more in just a minute. And my lines are full, so we'll be talking with some more callers. I do want to tell folks about upcoming programs on Focus, and we'll do that in just a minute. We'll get back to our topic here. On Monday at 11 o'clock, we'll talk about small business development, and our guests will be Tom Trone and Bob Hill from the U of I Small Business Institute. On Tuesday, obsessive compulsive disorder is our topic, and our guest there will be Judith Rappaport, who's chief of the child psychiatry branch of the National Institute of Mental Health, and author of a recent book that's gotten some attention, The Boy Who Couldn't Stop Washing, about the experience and treatment of obsessive compulsive disorder. Next week on Thursday, David Goodman will be here, an associate professor of Japanese and comparative literature at the U of I, talking about Japanese attitudes towards Jews and Israel. Some observers of Japan have been very concerned lately about what they see as increasing anti-Semitism in Japan. We'll talk about that on Thursday. And the next Friday, household hazardous waste is the topic. We all have a lot of products around the house that are really hazardous waste. You should look sometime under your kitchen sink and look at some of the stuff you have down there. Things that really should not go into a landfill or disposed of in the usual way. We'll talk a little bit about that next week, Friday, 1 week from today at 11 o'clock. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics for you every week. Your need to know continues through the afternoon. That's why there is AM 580's Afternoon Magazine. Every day from noon to 4, your host, Steve Harden, presents a lineup which includes news, sports, market information, and weather. Also this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour, Steve will be discussing the end of the celebrity with a media studies professor who has considered the changing role of our society's famous people. And of course, your phone calls are welcome this afternoon. It's the Afternoon Magazine, starting at noon here on AM 580. AM 580 would like to thank business sustainer, the John Warner Bank in Clinton, for contributing to the WILL Fund for Excellence. This is AM 580. It's a radio service supported by the listeners, the friends of WILL. This is Focus 580. It's our telephone talk program. And our guest this morning is Alma Gottlieb, an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois. We're talking about menstruation, how it's viewed in this culture and in others. And we have a bunch of people here to talk to, so I'm going to get right back to the telephones and go first to line number 2 for our next caller. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. This is not exactly in regard to menstruation, but it is somewhat related. And I was wondering if the occurrence of postpartum depression and some of the other violent episodes women have experienced after the birth of a child is also culturally specific.
You know, I'm really interested that you mentioned that, because I actually have thought that that might be the next thing I take up once I'm done with menstruation, because it strikes me as extraordinarily similar. Mm-hmm. When I think of the women whom I knew in Africa who gave birth, the notion of postpartum depression would be quite bizarre to them. And my suspicion is that postpartum, but I don't want to say this definitively, it's a hunch, it is that postpartum depression is the result of the way we live physically. That is, the fact that women go home from the hospital and are all alone. In Africa, when women give birth, first of all, they don't usually go anyplace to give birth. They give birth in their own homes, or possibly they go back to their mother's homes and give birth in their mother's homes. And usually somebody comes in and cooks for them for a week or a month, and they are anything but alone. In the village that I lived in among the Beng, after a woman gives birth, everybody in the village, every woman, every man, and every child, and in some villages that could be 1,000 people, march into that woman's room that very day to congratulate her. So there is a permanent line outside of her door for about 10 hours of people just coming in saying, congratulations, what did you have? And she says, a girl or a boy, and they say, congratulations, thank God. And that happens for 10 hours. And after that, all of her relatives just stick around and help her. And it's very difficult to imagine a space for postpartum depression in a situation like that, where you're continually being given aid and help. And in the U.S., where a woman comes home to a lonely household, very often her husband goes back to work that Monday and she's stuck alone, possibly a mother or mother-in-law might be there, very often not. I know after the birth of my first child, I encouraged all of my friends to come see me, and a lot of my my older friends were very appalled at the notion that I'd be having visitors, and they seemed to think that there was... I was somehow not a fit mother because I couldn't handle my child myself and I needed people to be coming around. And of course, I found it very comforting. But I suspect that postpartum depression is the result of the way we live and the way we just sort of, you know, exile women after they give birth. And all of a sudden, she's supposed to know how to be a mother after never having seen mothers in action, because mothering is a very private thing in America.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you. Another caller here. We'll go to the toll-free line.
Really only caught hold in the 50s, so it's only about 30 years old that we've even heard the term. And in fact, in terms of the popular consciousness, it's really only the past 10 or 15 years. But before PMS, as David suggested earlier, the popular consciousness tended to associate the time of the menstrual period itself as a time of psychic upheaval. So that's been around for at least 150 years, and before that, we really don't have good information.
Okay. Second one, when you talked about blaming on women's bodies, sometimes I think we do that with kids and sex.
Hmm.
You know, in the Christian church, traditionally, this has been a behavior thing, and you said the behavior is wrong, and you didn't see as much of it.
Hmm.
Maybe because we allow the behavior, might we be seeing more of it?
I'm not sure if I grasp what you're saying. Could you be a little more specific?
Well, we used to tell teenagers that sex is wrong if they're married.
Yeah, right.
Now we say they can't help their bodies.
Right.
And so let's find some way to fix it rather than telling them stop the behavior.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's a good possibility. Yeah. In the case of women, yeah, I mean, just the fact that we continually are interested in women and their bodies, as I mentioned, I think is culturally significant. I mean, if you look at the hormonal research, for instance, you know, in the popular media, you're just always reading articles about women and hormones, female hormones, female hormones. You just don't read popular articles about men's relationship to their hormones. And the endocrinological research on hormones is just unbelievably weighted in the direction of women. You just don't see much research being done on the cyclical relationship of men to their hormones. And we know that men have hormones, and we know that they change, that there are cycles, that there are ups and downs. And for instance, it's never really occurred to researchers to look at the possibility of men's moods being associated with their hormones. Personally, I don't think that it would happen, but it's interesting because I don't think it really happens with women either. But it's interesting that the scientific community has decided to explore the relationship between women's hormones and women's moods and not the relationship between men's hormones and men's moods. So I agree. I mean, the fact that it's just in the public consciousness that we talk about women's bodies, I think, is a powerful sort of unconscious socializer for women into the whole worldview.
Mm. Let's go on here and talk with another caller to line number three. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I have two questions. First of all, how do you deal with research along the medical model, which demonstrates decreased PMS with certain vitamins and minerals, decreased caffeine, decreased sugar, mm-hmm. decreased salt, exercise mm-hmm. and stress management,
mm-hmm.
Using a very logical argument that exercise in particular increases the release of endorphins, which increases the release of progesterone.
Mm-hmm. The research that's been done is very contradictory. The most recent study that I've seen on the relationship between PMS and vitamins, and I'm sorry, I don't have the information right at my fingertips, but I can get it for you if you're interested, actually demonstrates no relationship whatsoever between vitamin therapy and PMS. That's the very latest that I can come up with. It's a couple months old. There may be something more recent. But in general, before that, the really striking thing about PMS research has been that no matter what women were given, it seemed that they did better. In other words, without meaning to sound as if I'm denigrating women, there seemed to be a very strong placebo effect in the research that's been done on what women have been given for PMS. And my interpretation of that is that women who have PMS, in many cases, are looking for a space for legitimacy. They're looking for, as they themselves tell me and tell other researchers, they're looking for someone to listen to them. And if it's going to be a doctor, that's often sufficient. And in terms of the endorphin research, that's suggestive, but not yet conclusive. Did you have another question?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I was wondering if you've considered the possibility that because American culture emphasizes that caffeine is okay, sugar is okay,
mm-hmm.
we have a high-salt diet, we do not exercise,
mm-hmm.
that is a very big variable that mm-hmm. maybe should be compared between American culture and third-world countries where women do not eat those types of things like caffeine, sugar,
mm-hmm.
salt, and they do exercise much mm-hmm. more than American women. Is mm-hmm. that a possible explanation for the differences?
Conceivably. The research seems to be pretty good that cramps are often alleviated by eliminating salt and caffeine and sugar and especially things like chocolate from the diet, and certainly those things are absent from lots of third-world women's diets. So that's definitely a possibility. Again, the mood changes I'm very skeptical about, but certainly the physical changes, it's a good possibility. In terms of mood changes, if I could just amplify maybe some of my earlier comments with a comparative note,
mm-hmm.
One of the things that's interesting about the menstrual experience in America, similar to the experience of new mothers, which I was just commenting on, is that it's a lonely affair. American women tend not to broadcast the fact that they're menstruating. In fact, quite the opposite. We usually do as much to conceal the fact, and ads on TV that entice you to buy menstrual products to have as a subtext, essentially, no one will know. You know, you can do everything, and no one will know that you're doing this thing called menstruating. And that experience, I think, itself tends to shape very powerfully the way that we're going to experience menstruation. And in other cultures, a very peculiar fact has been observed that some American women have sort of noticed on their own That is that when women, groups of women live together, they tend to wind up being on the same cycle. Women, young girls who've been to camp together and lived in bunks together often report this, and sometimes young women in dormitories on college campuses report it. And in the non-Western world, where you have large groups of women living together communally in large houses, several anthropologists have documented the fact that, these women's cycles tend to get synchronized and they're menstruating at the same time. And so the mental experience of menstruation in a situation where all the women living together under one roof are menstruating at the same time, I suspect, would also be very different. And in one particular case that's been documented by my co-editor, Thomas Buckley, who worked with the Yurok Indians of California, the women who lived together in longhouses not only menstruated together, but for 10 days out of every month, that is one-third of their fertile lives, during menstruation and for a couple days before and after, they absented themselves from the house so that the house for two-thirds of the time was co-ed, but one-third of the time was all male. All the women left the house when they were menstruating and secluded themselves by a river, which was considered sacred, and for 10 days engaged in rituals which purified them and got them in touch with certain spirits that the Yurok worshipped and was said to give the women good luck and possibly access, actually, to greater wealth and treasure. Mm. So in a situation where women are menstruating collectively and dealing with it as a collective fact, that itself may incline women, perhaps, to have a more positive attitude towards it. And as an interesting footnote, there are some hints that among that group of people, the Yurok Indians, men themselves had a rather negative impression of menstruation and saw it as polluting, but the women themselves didn't.
That's very interesting. We have just about 10 minutes left. I have several callers, and I want to get to them. I'll also tell people who have just tuned in, Alma Gottlieb is our guest. She's an assistant professor of anthropology at University of Illinois. There is one quick question that I'd like to ask you. Some feminists have gotten together, and they have developed contemporary rituals to mark the first menstruation by a young woman, and also menopause. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
I think if they enjoy it, it's wonderful. I think that in places in the world where rituals are done traditionally to mark the beginning of menstruation and the end of menstruation, there's a certain likelihood that girls will feel better about their periods. Among a group in Africa called the Ashanti, who are rather well known, when a girl starts menstruating, she is sat out publicly in the public plaza, and she sits under an umbrella that's a state umbrella that's normally reserved for kings and other dignitaries. And the entire village marches by her and gives her presents in the form of coins or little trinkets, and all the women and girls of the village dance in front of her, and she's dressed in white and given white powder, and she's essentially celebrated. And what's being celebrated is the possibility of her, the beginning of her reproductive life and the fact that she can now be a mother, potentially. Now, in America, where motherhood is a much more private thing and certainly isn't celebrated for everybody, where motherhood is an option that not all women exercise, you know, it would be peculiar to have a ritual like that. But in among the Ashanti, it works because motherhood is celebrated. It's something that women look forward to. And it's, I would suspect that it would certainly make women feel pretty good about their periods.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with some other people here. Line number one is our next caller. Hello.
Yes. I'm curious how you collected the data from the other cultures. Was it just simply self-reports?
Mm-hmm. Well, in my case, the research that I did myself in Africa, I talked to women. I just asked them, you know, what happens at menstruation, and they told me. One of the frustrating things about the anthropological literature on menstruation is that it's very scanty and really buried, and there just isn't very much of it in the way of the kinds of questions that I think we're interested in now, that is individuals' own experiences. And I'm hoping that the book that we put together will, you know, stimulate a whole new generation of research along the question, the lines of questions that I think you're getting at, you know, just asking women, what is it like? there are just a few anthropologists who have done that. And I think one of the reasons is that we've tended to assume that menstruation is sort of a biological phenomenon and that there's not really all that much interesting going on. And I think it's only recently that we've started to wonder, well, maybe we don't understand everything and maybe women experience things very differently.
I guess I was just wondering if... I would be surprised if a woman who had menstruated, say, less than 10 times, as mm-hmm. the example you gave, mm-hmm. would even notice the pattern.
Mm.
As I had a friend that was about 21 years old just told me recently that she had, for the first time in her life, something had happened where she started crying when she was teased,
mm-hmm.
and she was very surprised that this happened, and she couldn't figure it out, and suddenly she realized, my God, I must have PMS. I must have this mood change.
Right.
Now, it could have been a coincidence.
Right.
But there's a woman who's probably menstruated for 7 years
mm-hmm.
and never noticed the pattern,
mm-hmm.
or else it just developed. That's another possibility.
Mm-hmm.
But considering that she may have just never noticed the pattern,
mm-hmm.
I wonder if maybe higher numbers of women where you collect data from and more, I know it would be difficult to do a mood scale, but I'm just wondering if you're coming to a conclusion too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, it's a possibility. I'll never rule out any reasonable criticism.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there have been quite a lot of studies of women's moods in America. And a really striking thing emerges in these studies, and I myself have noticed it with groups of women that I've interviewed talking about menstruation, and that is that women who believe in PMS, who are aware of it, and who think that that it's a legitimate disease, tend to blame essentially all mood swings that are associated in their minds with PMS on PMS. Whether or not, in fact, it's the premenstrual portion of the month. And in one study in particular that I'm thinking of, there was a really striking pattern of women continually blaming headaches, in particular, on PMS, even though it might be at any point during the month at all. So my point is that PMS has now entered American consciousness so deeply that it may... really persuade us that certain symptoms are associated with PMS, whether or not, in terms of the rhythm of the month, they should be.
Let's go on to caller on line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question deals with the issue of sexuality in Judeo-Christian culture in general and also male domination in Judeo-Christian culture. And it just seems that sexuality in general is considered dirty, and menstruation is called a curse,
mm-hmm.
and women are unclean
mm-hmm.
because of this occurrence.
Mm-hmm.
And the culture has been male dominated for so long. And I was wondering about Islam,
mm-hmm.
and whether there were any comparisons that you could make with Islam, because it's a male-dominated culture, and
mm-hmm.
the religion springs out of Judeo-Christian
mm-hmm.
tradition. But it seems as if there must be some differences, and I was wondering if what you think about that issue, the issue of sort of repression of the natural biological function in Judeo-Christian culture, male domination,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing, and whether or not women, from the time that they're very young, are sort of made to feel bad about their bodies,
mm-hmm.
bad about their sexuality, bad about when menstruation first occurs. It's a dirty thing. It's something
mm-hmm.
to be ashamed of.
Mm-hmm.
And birth in general also is considered as a disease, sort of an unnatural thing. It's the result of the curse from the sin and all that kind of thing.
And I
thought I'd just throw that out and let you comment on that.
Yeah, there's lots of juicy stuff in there to comment on. In terms of Islam, actually there are quite a lot of similarities, perhaps not surprisingly, as you know, since Islam is a religion of the book and did grow out of the Judeo-Christian tradition. In my book, Blood Magic, there is an article by an anthropologist named Carol Delaney, who looks at Islam as it's practiced in Turkey, and she comes to, essentially the conclusion that Islam, as in its Quranic base, really encourages the view of menstruation as dirty and polluting and so forth in ways that are very similar to the Judeo-Christian tradition. And the whole notion of the curse, I think, really contains a key to the Western understanding of menstruation. If you think about the place of the curse in Genesis, in the Bible, menstruation, in its biblical view, is seen as a curse upon women. I mean, it's quite simple, and it's difficult to extricate ourselves from that perspective. And that's certainly not the case elsewhere. Just to give a really dramatic counterexample, among a group in Ivory Coast called the Ebrie, if somebody steals something from somebody, if it's a man who's the thief, it's said that he is going to be punished by impotence, and that will work as a curse. And if it's a woman who steals, the curse upon her will be amenorrhea, that is, loss of her period. So among the Ebrie, the curse is literally losing your period rather than gaining it. And, you know, you can't really come up with a stronger counterexample of how the curse is just not a universal view of menstruation. But I think you're right. Our general notions of the relationship of women and sexuality in all of its spheres, from menstruation to childbirth, are very tied in with our biblical basis of the curse and women's being cursed with sexuality as a result of the role in Genesis.
We're going to have to stop. We've come to the end of our time, and my apologies, I have one last caller we just won't be able to take. It's been very, very interesting, and I appreciate you being with us, Professor Gottlieb. And also, I'll mention the book once again for folks who are interested in reading some more on this topic. They can look for the book that Professor Gottlieb has co-edited. There are also some of her writing in there. The title of the book is Blood Magic, The Anthropology of Menstruation, and it is published by the University of California Press. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.